Happy Thanksgiving. This is Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. For this holiday edition of Ozarks, we're featuring a few interviews we've done recently with authors from around the country. The first time these conversations have been on our daily show. We also have today's editions of Earth Sky and Writer's Almanac. We begin today's book fair edition of Ozarks at Large with Patricia Adams. She co-founded the Natural Resources Defense Council, the NRDC, with her husband John 40 years ago. The story of the founding of the NRDC and what's happened since makes up the bulk of the memoir, A Force of Nature, co-written by John and Patricia Adams with George Black. I asked Patricia Adams about the late 1960s when the NRDC was founded. This was just after a major oil spill near Santa Barbara, after the infamous polluted condition of the Cuyahoga River in Ohio had made national headlines.
That's what it's easy to forget, that what things were like 40 years ago, and when the waters really were polluted throughout the United States, the air was very dirty, and then it was really with these first early laws, NEPA, that allowed citizens to sue and citizens to participate in protecting the environment. And that was when NRDC got started. It paralleled a lot of other movements in the United States at that time. If you remember, it was an exciting time with the civil rights movement, women's movement was starting, the peace movement, and it was a time when people felt they could change the world. And there was that spirit with NRDC in 1970 when it started. And as it turned out, in many ways, we, the collective, have changed the world, and I think in many ways for the better, even though we still have a lot of work to do.
When you look back with a historical bent and you look at Cuyahoga and you look at Santa Barbara oil spill, it's easy to say, well, of course, movements coalesced and came together, but it wasn't that easy at first, was it?
It certainly wasn't that easy. It wasn't a slam dunk at all. But there was also personal reasons for John and I, because you could just see what was happening to our own family. We were living in Manhattan, and as we say in the book, if one of our children slept near an open window, there would be ash on their forehead because garbage was simply burned in the basements of apartment buildings, and the river ran dirty as well. And there was one thing that helped bring this all together, though, and that was the fight in the Hudson Highlands to save Storm King Mountain, a famous, beautiful mountain that was painted by the Hudson River painters. And Con Edison had proposed a pump storage plant there, which would have really defaced the mountain, put in power lines, and it would have been quite destructive and killed a lot of fish. There was a small group of actually attorneys in their 50s and their wives who formed an organization to try to stop Con Ed. And what they learned is they thought it was very expensive to come up against a large corporation. And they had this really beneficent view that most people in the world could never have afforded to do that. So they wanted to start an organization, a public interest law firm that would represent the public and, in a way, represent environment. And they hired John, and this is slightly apocryphal. They said, we'll hire you for about $25,000 a year. Your first job is to go find that money, you know, for your salary. And we had three young children, so they sent John to Ford Foundation. And Ford had a group of young lawyers. They were young, they were somewhat ribald and tricky, and they were a little nervous to fund this group of 25-year-olds who were graduates of Yale Law School and had a lot of energy and ideas about what they wanted to do. But they said to John and they said to the Yale group, if you all can come together and form an organization, we will give you initial funding. And it started small in that way. There were maybe 9 or 10 people involved and a very small board. But one of the themes of the book and the way we still think is you may start small, but always think big.
You know, so at the beginning, 1969, early 70s, there are obvious environmental problems, things that are easy to show in pictures or slides. As you move into the 70s and 80s and start being concerned with pesticides, that became trickier because you couldn't see pesticides. That was something that happened before the food or whatever got to our table or our grocery store.
Right. One of the things, again, starting small and thinking big, one thing I'll just say as an overview, with the Environmental Protection Agency listing things that are in our foods and chemicals and those kinds of things are not really toxic until they're proved toxic. So it's a kind of a reverse of what it should be that NRDC scientists are always fighting. Don't wait until you prove something's bad and then go back and take it off the market, but let's check things beforehand. It's a very complicated process. But one of the things NRDC NBC did about this. Started out with simply Laurie Mott and Al Meyerhoff, and here in the San Francisco office, going to the supermarket and buying groceries. So they bought a market basket full of groceries, and they had them tested. And they found there were incredible numbers of pesticides, including DDT, on the fruit and vegetables that had been, outlawed for years in the United States. And with this small start, again, they began to examine and bring lawsuits against companies that were putting pesticides and other kinds of toxic elements on apples. And it led to the famous and infamous in some ways Alar case that still NRDC has been proved right in the long run, and that was that the amount of Alar, which was a chemical that was also used in World War II bombing, was in exorbitant proportions to children. A toddler drinks a lot more apple juice, therefore eats a lot more apples even than an adult. And the toxic testing was done on a 160-pound adult. But what about this little kid walking around drinking apple juice? And it also shows that personal interest is always important in NRDC, because the women that worked on this case had young children and were very concerned about toxics in the environment and for their children. And it really helped found the whole organic movement that's very big in the United States now and is great, and sustainable development, all those things that tie together.
I'm talking with Patricia Adams. She is the co-author of A Force for Nature, the story of NRDC and the fight to save our planet. We could talk for hours about some of the very familiar and headline-grabbing topics that are in the book, like the Exxon Valdez and the creation of the LEED green building standards. But I want to ask you about a couple of, I think, perhaps not well-known episodes that just I found very fascinating when I was reading about the book. One was about the organization when James Watt, who was Secretary of Interior, was proposing 1 billion acres to be made ready for offshore drilling. 1 billion acres. And the way things came together to reduce the amount of land, offshore land, that would be available for drilling. It was you, it was the NRDC, Robert Redford, and some other people that came together. And it was quite an interesting strategy that developed. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Are you talking about the meeting in Morro Bay?
Yes.
With Robert Redford?
Yes.
And the Institute for Resource Management. I just want to say that Robert Redford, we all, of course, know of him as a great actor and founder of Sundance, but he's also been committed to environmental issues since very early on. And he was a man before his time when he formed this Institute for Resource Management, which brought together people from the corporate world, also Native Americans, and environmentalists. Oh, let's come to the table and see if we can work something out. It was an idea before its time in many ways. The meeting you're referring to was in Morro Bay in California. And they got together with basically the oil companies about drilling on the up in Alaska in the Bering Sea. And what they did was they simply had this map, and we still have it in the offices at New York, a sort of a map of the Bering Sea. And they said, okay, let's agree. If you want to drill in certain places, we environmentalists will not bring lawsuits against you. But these are places we absolutely want to protect. And if you drill here, then we will see you in court. And then these negotiable areas sort of in the middle. So they negotiated this. And as they were talking, one of the executives looked at it and said, you mean you really will leave us alone? If we leave you alone there and you won't bring a lawsuit? And John said, yes, we guarantee. And it was a kind of an agreement that, I mean, things changed and went on. They brought this agreement to Washington, and I think it was Hodel he had taken Watt's place. And even though at the time he kind of, as the Secretary of the Interior, said, well, that's our job, that's not your job. But in the end, they sort of followed this pattern. So again, there's subtle ways and obvious ways that things change. And you're right, to bring this up, it's a little-known issue or a little-known case for NRDC, but it was very important at the time.
And then there is the topic of acoustic smog, sounds in the oceans, and how that can hurt marine animals.
Joel Reynolds in the Los Angeles office, actually, he comes from a family of musicians. This sound is a part of his life. And he read somewhere that they were testing the water temperature by using sonar sound, which seems benign in a way, but it led him to see, okay, now what are these sonar ripples doing to the marine mammals there? And study studies found that they do horrible things. They make their eardrums burst. They push them to the surface. And they found, you know, any area where the Navy or anybody is testing with sonar, you have beached whales. And you can just parallel it and see what's happening. So Joel brought this lawsuit against, actually, the U.S. Navy. And that's pretty brave to do that. And because it is, as you refer to, acoustic smog, just what it's doing to the marine mammals in our ocean, and travel sounds for miles, thousands of miles. And also that's the way animals get their food. That's the way they communicate. So it's extraordinarily destructive. Now, this this lawsuit's gone all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was, some of it was dismissed, but again, some of these things are incremental. And this issue is now on the table and is now in public, and I think we'll continue to make progress on that issue of sonar testing.
And what was so interesting is the trite way to explain many environmental controversies or lawsuits is to say it's these people against corporations. This was initiated by scientists. These were people who were trying to figure out, you know, the health of the ocean.
That's true. And not only with scientists, but I have to leap forward a little bit and say many corporations and businesses today do believe that green is good, not because for moral issues, but because it's good business. So we're finding more cooperation. I think the biggest issue, though, that we do have to refer to is the climate change and the fact that humanity is dependent right now on fossil fuels. And we're going to the ends of the earth to get these fossil fuels. I mean, you just look at the Gulf, how deep they have to drill now for oil. The tar sands up in Canada, we're really abusing the earth to get fossil fuels. And our real hope in the future is to find alternatives to these fossil fuels. And money does support oil and gas and coal industries and the railroads. So that is a big issue, too, to work towards not only corporation but new technology.
Are you optimistic? Because we are in such, and have been for some time, but it's a sort of soundbite culture and a name-calling, finger-pointing sort of public discussion over important issues. Are you optimistic that there can be meaningful, widespread public discussions about these topics?
I don't know about how many public discussions. You know, climate change is sort of vague for a lot of people. It's not right in front of them. But doing this book tour and talking to people, sometimes I'm standing in a room with people and I look at them, and number one, I realize they weren't even born in 1970, right? They're under 30, many of them. But then at the same time, they pull out their iPhone, and I think, you know what? These young people understand technology in general, but also specifically in a way, literally within their hands may be the way to change the future. And I think that getting fossil fuels, if you just argue economically, is going to get so expensive that there will be alternative waves. And I hope there's a better education and that our book participates in that education about the dangers we're involved with and how important it is to find alternatives and things like efficiency. But on the other hand, it's not just gloom and doom. People just walk away from gloom and doom and kind of shake their head and say, well, what can I do? Well, a lot can be done, and we're hoping this book is more positive in that sense.
Is there a sense that when you're on this book tour and when you're talking to people, it's the choir you're preaching to, and you hope that they then spread the message?
Well, in all honesty, it is sometimes the choir. And what we're hoping is that the book, I mean, Kyle, I'm sure people listening to you, this may be new to them, this book and these ideas. So we're hoping that through some of these interviews that people who normally might not even hear about the book will and be interested in reading it. And it is a good read because it's stories of the people who tried to bring these changes. So we're hoping that the book will break out a little bit beyond the already committed environmentalists, as you say. But anyway, at least we have a choir.
And Patricia Adams, thank you so much for your time.
Well, thank you, Kyle. It was great to talk with you.
Patricia Adams is co-author of A Force of Nature with her husband John H. Adams and George Black. This is a book fair edition of Ozarks at Large. Next up, a 600-page cookbook for the common sense chef. That conversation ahead. This is a book fair edition of Ozarks at Large. I'm Kyle Kellums. Thanksgiving means many things, and almost all of them are included in the new cookbook, The Common Sense Kitchen by Tom Hudgens. There's food, of course, but also essays about why we should be thankful for our food. I began the discussion with Tom Hutchins by telling him even though the cookbook is brand new, it has the feel and appearance of a cookbook that has been handed down for a few generations.
I appreciate you saying that, Kyle. I actually, and I think you probably know this with most authors, I had no control over the actual look of the book. However, when it was in the production process, I just had to have faith that Chronicle, you know, which is a publisher known for their beautiful books, that they would do right by the book, and they certainly did. They really paid attention to the text and paid attention to the aesthetic that I was trying to evoke with the recipes and the text, which is a timeless kind of feeling. And there are aspects of the book that are very modern and aspects of it that are very old-fashioned all at once. And they really captured that. It's sort of a hard balance to strike, but design-wise, I think they did a beautiful job. And I couldn't be more pleased with it.
And as wonderful as it looks now in its brand new state, it's going to look so much better when it has some flour and a stain here and some.
Oh, absolutely! I think so. A little tomato sauce stain.
Exactly.
And you know, maybe some wear on the cover. It's just going to get better and better looking.
This is a book that was born in more than one way at Deep Springs. Tell me about Deep Springs.
Yes. Deep Springs is a unique place on Earth. It's a place very dear to my heart. It's a 2-year college they have a very, very rigorous academic program there. And the way that it works is you go there for your first 2 years of college, and then you transfer to a 4-year university. And it is situated on a real working cattle ranch in the eastern part of California, out in the high desert. It's a very, very small student body. Only 12 to 13 are admitted each year, and so the whole student body is 24 to 26. And the last, you know, among many unique things about the place, it's all male, has been since it was founded in 1917, and just because of the logistics and the size of the place, they haven't managed to go co-ed, and many of us in the Deep Springs family wish that there were a similar place for women, a similar program for, you know, that women would have the opportunity to attend. But, you know, that's still in the future.
And it's where you, as a student, kind of became acquainted with cooking.
Yes, it is. I had the great fortune of going there as a student, and when you're there, you, of course, take these rigorous college-level courses, but you also do about 20 to 25 hours of physical labor on the ranch each week, and in any number of capacities. There are students that milk the cows. There are students that feed the animals, cook the meals, clean up after the meals, work on the computer networks. You know, there are a number of jobs, and you rotate through a number of different positions during your 2 years there. And my first job, among my first jobs, was student cook. And I'd cooked before, and I loved cooking and had a few dishes. I did well at that point. But this was a real eye-opening experience for me. It was really hard, extremely challenging, a lot of pressure, but it was really fun and very gratifying when I succeeded. So that's where I first started, you know, really getting my feet wet with cooking. And then when I transferred to Cornell, I continued cooking for my job. I always needed to work all the way through college. And after Deep Springs, I always did cooking, worked in restaurants, did catering, that kind of thing. So that's how I got my start.
I'm talking with Tom Hutchins. He's the author of The Common Sense Kitchen, 500 recipes plus lessons for a handcrafted life. This is a cookbook that works especially well for novices, but also for experienced cooks.
That's exactly what I hope. In some ways, I wrote it for novices. However, I wrote it for ambitious novices. You know, the guys at Deep Springs, they'll come in and they've never cooked before, and they want to make a classic textbook creme brulee. You know, they don't want to start off with baked custard and, you know, go through the progression. No, they want to start with something kind of tricky and hard, and so that's just how they are. I always call them ambitious. ambitious beginners, and so I wanted to account for their desires to make, you know, some really fancy stuff in addition to the nice good old fashioned comfort food stuff that we like to eat, you know, as well. So that's partly where the breadth of the book comes from. Is this is the stuff that interested them and interested me when I was that age too, and continues to.
Before you get to recipes in this book, there are definitions of essential implements that you would use and essential terms. If you don't know what braise or deglaze means, you will if you go through the first, you know, 50 pages here.
Exactly. I thought that introductory content, I thought that was important to put that in. A lot of people already know some of that stuff, but since I refer to it in the recipes, I thought it was important to give my, you know, my rundown on why I think this is important. So I like to think that it has almost everything you'd need, you know, in terms of what you'd need all in one volume to just really get started in the kitchen and really get cooking and be able to, you know, come out of the experience making a few, you know, good meals from scratch for yourself and your family. That's kind of what it's all about.
There are many recipes in this book that begin with someone's name, Mama Nell's or Catherine's corn soup.
Yep. And Aretha's macaroni and cheese.
Mm-hmm.
These are women, and mostly it's women that I've named recipes after. Some of them are my relatives. You know, Mama Nell's Kentucky bourbon balls. That's my grandmother, and my mother has a couple of her recipes in there. You know, because that's where most of us get our recipes still. And I use these dishes even when I was a professional cook and caterer. I relied on these dishes, and so writing the cookbook, I couldn't leave them out. And I think it's really important to get a sense of the continuity that these recipes are traditional, and you know, they go back a long way. And you could serve some of this stuff to your great grandmother, and she would instantly recognize it. I love that a recipe is kind of something old-fashioned, but it's also something right there in the present moment as well.
Why don't you pick the word common sense?
That, common sense was originally suggested by my mother.
And you should listen to your mother, yes.
So I like that she came up with that that first. The working title of the book was always The Deep Springs Cookbook. Not the working title, but the title of the earlier incarnations that I would give as a gift to the students at Deep Springs as they graduated. I would give them a small cookbook as a sort of parting gift. Here you go, guys. You're on your way to, you know, starting off on your adult lives. Here's a cookbook, and it was greatly appreciated. That's kind of how this whole thing got started. And of course, that was always called the Deep Springs Cookbook. But when I was working this up to reach a wider audience, I knew that calling something the Deep Springs Cookbook really wouldn't mean much to most people. And so we thought and we thought and we thought and we thought about what could be a perfect new title for this book, and we finally settled on the Common Sense Kitchen.
If you want to know a good recipe for beef stew, this book has you covered.
Yep.
There are 9 kinds of beef stew in here.
Yep. All based on one recipe, but the technique is pretty much the same. And just some of the additions to the pot are what changes. You know, there's a Mexican version, Mexican braised beef that has some chili and some delicious sweet spices in it, and that variation offers, you know, ways to serve that or things to serve it with. And then there's a classic French version that you make with all red wine and mushrooms and bacon. And there's a number version. There's one that really bolsters up the vegetables, you know, makes it into really healthy winter comfort food. And that's how I cook. I do a lot of variations on themes, and sometimes it's hard for me to cook the same recipe exactly the same way twice.
This is a impressive book by size, more than 550 pages of explanation and recipes. Did anything get left out?
Well, not really.
Good.
I was able to put in everything that I wanted. There were a few things at the end that I had to really critically look at, and like, well, you know, there's a lot of recipes that resemble this one. So I did edit a little bit, but basically, no, I was able to put everything in and they agreed with it. So it was a really happy experience for me as an author.
There's hummus, there's salsas, there's iced tea. It runs the gamut.
Yeah, there's a lot in there. What I like to think, and you know, maybe someone will actually try to do this, but if you were to cook just out of this book, lunch and dinner every day for yourself and your family, you wouldn't get bored for a really long time, because there's enough there to keep you going with the variations and the suggestions. And if you have this particular vegetable, here's a couple of ways you can use it, that kind of thing. I designed it, I wrote it to be, you know, really versatile like that, and to address pretty much any situation that someone would find themselves in, any part of the country or any season of the year. You know, there'll be something in here that would hopefully spark your imagination and interest.
Help me out here with a term. I'm not sure I'm going to say this correctly. Red onion galette?
Galette, that's exactly it. It's a free-form pie, just baked on a baking sheet. You roll out the dough, big circle, put your filling in the middle. In this case, it's a savory cheese topped with some delicious sautéed red onions, and then you fold the crust over the filling and bake it like that. It's a free-form pie. It's absolutely delicious.
You make grits look easy.
I love grits.
Oh, I do too.
Yeah. And, you know, I've recently discovered really delicious grits that are being grown in the South right now with heirloom varieties of corn, the way grits used to taste 100 years ago. And there's Anson Mills, I believe they're in South Carolina, and there's a number of other mills in that part of the country that are reviving this wonderful Southern corn tradition, and I think that's great. But I love grits. Even the regular old refined kind you get here in California are pretty good.
you mentioned in the Common Sense Kitchen that people should appreciate their food before you know, ingesting it.
That's absolutely essential. And we're a big old country with lots of different religious beliefs, but I grew up praying before meals. And then for a long time I didn't, and now I do again in a way. And I think however you feel about a higher being or whatever, that appreciation of the food that's right there in front of you is really important, because no matter what, there's a whole bunch of people and that somehow produced that food. Even if it's something you grew yourself in your garden, where did you get the seeds, and how did you get it watered, and how did you get it fertilized? And, you know, maybe it was all you, but just to be thankful for yourself in that case. Or, you know, even at a restaurant, it's like you look down at your plate when you finally, the waiter brings it, and you think of all the people that had something to do with all that food on the plate, and it really kind of gets mind-boggling. And so I like to take a minute and think about all those people and have gratitude for them, and just have gratitude for this delicious food that is going to fuel our bodies. I think that's a really important moment, and I think it sets my body ready to receive it, and it makes it taste better, and it helps me, you know, slow down and enjoy it more. And we can all use a little of that, I think.
You know, when it was confirmed that this was my kind of cookbook, When I read these words under pumpkin pie, under the entry for pumpkin pie,
okay,
for a breakfast version of this pie,
oh, yeah.
And I said, okay, here's someone who thinks like I do.
I love pie for breakfast. That's one of my favorite things, the day after Thanksgiving, to go into the fridge and get out the pie, you know, once you keep it in the fridge, and just have a slice, eat it out of your hand. Oh, I love that. I really do love that. But I think that things like pies and that kind of thing, depending on how they're, you know, how much sugar there is and how much, can be perfect for breakfast. And also, pie used to be in, you know, my Southern relatives talk about big ranch breakfasts where pie was baked fresh and served every morning, along with things like fried chicken, you know, and I love that tradition.
Is it true that if someone asks you what your favorite food is, you say butter?
I do. I think that's getting right to the heart of the matter, you know?
And then just what you put around the butter.
Exactly.
What's the biggest, not mistake, but what's the biggest intimidation for a beginner, be they an ambitious beginner or a tentative beginner? What should a beginner at cooking look out for?
I think I would advise a beginner to look out for being overly ambitious with what they want to cook. That something very, very simple is great to start off with. And simple never means boring. It just means that it's simple. And And you can learn as a cook, especially as a beginning cook, if you're paying attention, you can learn a lot from just a simple sautéed vegetable. How it's cut and how it behaves in the pan, and you're tasting pieces of it to see if it's done. And now it's still a little crunchy. Oh no, now it's better. Oh, it needs salt. That kind of thing. You can learn a lot that way. And so I advise people to just not be overly ambitious, because if they are, it sets them up to possibly fail, not necessarily, but then they might get discouraged. So I just say, start off easy. Start off easy. Start with what you know. Start off, and then as you build confidence and as you gain knowledge, it will just come naturally what you want to do, and you can get more and more ambitious. And then you can, once you've mastered a few of the basics, you can spend a whole afternoon making, fresh pasta noodles or fresh ravioli or some, big project like that. And that can be great fun. But I find that there is a progression that beginning cooks really should go through. They should start off with some of the simple stuff and get some confidence and some skills there, and then go on to the more complicated stuff.
Now, at the end of any good meal, there are dirty dishes. And at the end of this cookbook, there are dirty dishes.
That's it.
Page 568, you tell us how to wash dishes.
Yeah, that's, some people might think that's unusual, but I didn't want to leave that out because everyone else leaves that out, and that's part of it. Whether you like it or not, that's part of it, and that's part of the whole craft of cooking and part of eating at home. And so I just thought that it would be useful, and some people might enjoy or might, learn a little from just, my little rundown on how I wash dishes. And it's comes from being a professional cook and all that, having to supervise the dishwashers at Deep Springs for years. I just thought that was part of it, and it wouldn't be complete without it. So that's in there too. And then following that is one of my favorite recipes in the book. It's for homemade soap that is made at Deep Springs from time to time. It's not like Deep Springs can't afford their own soap, but being a cattle ranch, there's a lot of beef tallow to use up. And so I devised a recipe, found this great little book, and started this recipe with a soap that has made from beef tallow and olive oil, and it's really lovely stuff. And so the students love making that. That's the very last recipe in the book.
And finally, this is a perfect companion to someone who is interested in the slow food movement.
Yes, yes, absolutely. Cooking, the kind of cooking that I like to do, sometimes it's quick and easy, but sometimes it's not, and I don't think that one of the messages that I try to send out to people is that cooking isn't necessarily work to be avoided. We get told that a lot. We get told, oh, you don't have time to cook. Cooking is too hard. It's too messy. It's too much trouble. But I like to look at it as a really vital craft, as part of what makes us human. It's incredibly fulfilling, and it's one of the best and most direct ways to nurture people. And so that's the message I'm trying to send out is that we do have the time to do this, and it is worthwhile. And it's really, really fulfilling. So I think that some of us have forgotten that, and I'm trying to get back to that.
The name of the book is The Common Sense Kitchen, 500 Recipes Plus Lessons for a Handcrafted Life. Tom, thanks so much for your time.
Thanks so much, Kyle. It's been great. Thank you.
Tom Hudgens' latest cookbook is the 500-recipe, 600-page book titled Common Sense Kitchen, 500-plus Recipes for a Handcrafted Life. This is a book fair edition of Ozarks at Large. Happy Thanksgiving. It's Thursday, November 25th, 2010. I'm Kyle Kellums. With me is Becca Baker-Martin. She is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers.
And I wish you joyous tidings, and may you eat yourself into a recliner.
Watch a little football.
May you eat yourself into a recliner.
All right. Do whatever you want to do on Thanksgiving.
We're going to look ahead at some of the things going on in December, because clearly there are not arts things going on today. December 2nd and 3rd, there's a Madrigal Dinner with the Bentonville High School Chamber Choir. 7 o'clock at First Christian Church in Bentonville. Tickets are $25. You can find all of this in What's Up, so I'm not going to read you phone numbers. But you'll know what's going on. December 3rd and 4th, University Theater is doing A Christmas Carol for three shows only at the Walton Arts Center. Tickets range from $15 to $23. Showtimes are 7 p.m. December 3rd and 2 and 7 December 4th. December 3rd through 5th, the Block Street Annual Holiday Art Sale.
Right.
Great stuff. Don House, Marie Demarukas, Susan Shore, Cindy Arcega, Faye Alter. 7 to 9 on December 3rd, 10 to 5 on December 4th, and noon to 5 on December 5th at the Good Folk House on Block Avenue. The Best Christmas Pageant Ever is back on stage at the Art Center of the Ozarks in Springdale, December 3rd and 4th at 7:30 and 3 p.m. December 5th. Tickets are $9 to $20. On December 4th, Joe Neal and Lynn Scambato will be doing a Holidayzer for the Birds presentation.
Where does this take place?
It's from 11 to 4 at the Shiloh Museum in Springdale, where many cool things happen. Also that night, there's a holiday concert featuring Five by Design and the Fort Smith Symphony.
Yes, yes.
7:30 at the Arkansas Best Performing Arts Center in Fort Smith. And the weekend of December 4th and 5th, two more Nutcrackers. Classical Ballet Academy's version featuring Molly Hedberg of Rogers as Clara. It's at 7:30 December 4th and 2 December 5th at the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville. And Ballet West Side's Nutcracker. And for the first time this year, the audience can meet the dancers at a sugar plum tea party.
Fun.
It'll be at the Heritage High School Auditorium in Rogers. And it's 7 p.m. December 4th and 2 p.m. December 5th. And it's the matinee version where you can go to the tea party.
Bunch of Christmas stuff, and we haven't even really scratched the surface yet.
But right now, I'm going back to my recliner.
All right. Happy Thanksgiving, Becca.
You too, Kyle.
Becca Bacon-Martin is the editor of What's Up, found in Northwest Arkansas newspapers every Friday, including tomorrow. This is Ozarks at Large. McSweeney's is a publishing house, but that doesn't do it justice in its description. Founded more than a decade ago by Dave Edgars, McSweeney's is home for a quarterly, for novels, for the magazine The Believer, for a series of DVDs, a series of oral histories titled Voice of Witness, and a blog at McSweeney's.net. Over the past 11 or 12 years, McSweeney's publications have included scores of talented writers and artists, names including Michael Chabon, Kevin Brockmeyer, Sarah Vowell, John Hodgman, Joyce Carol Oates, and David Byrne. To celebrate the 11th or 12th anniversary of McSweeney's, there is a new hardbound book, The Art of McSweeney's. Chris Ying is co-publisher of the book and joins me on the phone. Chris, welcome to Ozarks at Large.
Thanks. Nice to be with you.
It's if you're trying to explain McSweeney's to the uninitiated, it's not an easy thing to do, is it?
No. I mean, McSweeney's is a pretty diverse publishing company. We've got a lot of interests and a lot of different projects going on, and you know, each one has a pretty unique face of its own, so it is a little difficult to try and pin us down into one sentence, I guess.
what it strikes me about McSweeney's different endeavors and this book, The Art of McSweeney's, is that really every time you turn a page, you might be seeing something you just didn't expect to see in that journal or in the magazine or on the video.
Yeah, I think that every page of the book is giving you a different angle on something on independent publishing and the things we do. You know, each page, it's organized in some fashion where, you know, we'll be talking about The Believer and we won't randomly switch to talking about our quarterly fiction journal or something. But you're right, it's very eclectic in there, and you open it up and you'll see different stories from completely different time periods.
You can't go anywhere without hearing that the printed word, as we've known it for basically since Gutenberg, is dying. But I think McSweeney's publications say it doesn't have to. It can still be engaging, and it can still be something that catches your eye with design and great writing. Is that part of the idea?
Definitely, definitely. It seems like since Gutenberg, people have been saying that print is dying. Print is perpetually in a state of dying, or people are perpetually in a state of saying that print is dying, and we really don't believe that's true. And, this book is definitely a celebration of the printed form and of independent publishing and of books in general, and the fact that, you know, Chronicle Books took an interest in publishing a book about us and about our books just goes to show that there are people, you know, who care about having a printed book in their hand and care about how books are made and care about books continuing to be made.
I mentioned some of the writers that have been included in the journals and have been published by McSweeney's. So obviously there is great care for the words that are in the publications. But what strikes people first, of course, is the art, the diverse and sometimes utterly surprising art. How do you make these go together so well?
Well, you know, we have a philosophy here about design, and that is that, you know, these authors and writers and artists spend a great deal of their personal energies and, you know, dedicate themselves to creating these works of literature, these works of art and things like that. And so, you know, it's our obligation or our duty to try and package them as best we can and give them the presentation that they deserve. So, you know, their writing always inspires our design. And so we just try to do right by our authors is our main design principle, I think.
You know, when people hear about a quarterly, a, for lack of a better term, a literary quarterly, most people get the same sort of image in their head. You've got this somewhat oddly sized but consistently sized publication that comes out four times a year, and when you put it on a shelf, they'll all stack up neatly. That's not what happens with the McSweeney quarterlies.
Yeah, if you read the Art of McSweeney's book, there's a section where our first editor, Eli Horowitz, talks about how he and Jordan Bass, the managing editor of the quarterly, had come to terms a long time ago with the fact that if you try to stack our books up next to each other or on top of each other, it's not really going to look like anything. It'll just be a jumbled mess of differently shaped boxes and papers and things like that. And so we kind of like that eclectic feel. We like that every issue of the quarterly will be completely redesigned and subscribers will be surprised with what they see instead of finding the same shaped book every time.
And actually, when you put them then all in a row, it looks like a real person's bookshelf.
That's right. It looks like, you know, a person who has eclectic taste put together this collection instead of just, you know, a row of encyclopedias or something.
When you're dealing with this sort of eclecticism and trying not to be the same from publication to publication, it seems like that's a high level of difficulty. And I don't know, are there spirited discussions about design at McSweeney's about what is working and what isn't working on a publication in progress?
You know, I think that the nice thing about working here is that there are a few of us and there's not a lot of time for the spirited discussion about design. It's kind of like, If somebody has an idea and it sounds like it might work, then we should go ahead and try it, you know. And that's the beauty of getting to redesign the quarterly every single time, is we get to try as many different techniques and as many different pieces as we want. And, you know, the same with the novels and things like that, is every time we do another one, we have another chance to refine the design and change it up. So, yeah, I think we're kind of just a trial and error company. We're not a big discussion company.
I'm talking with Christine. He's co-publisher of The Art of McSweeney's, the new book out that celebrates the 11th or 12th anniversary. They're inside the book, Art of McSweeney's, that parenthetical question, whether it's the 11th or 12th anniversary, exists.
The 11th or 12th anniversary thing sort of came about because of how long it took us to put this book together. We kind of it was originally conceived, I think, as our 10th anniversary, and then as deadlines slipped by, it became the 11th, and then, you know, I think we put the 12th in there just to pad ourselves and give us some insurance against another blown deadline. So it's the 11th or 12th, probably closer to the 11th.
If you get the book, The Art of McSweeney's, and it, of course, has a dust cover, and it took me a few hours to realize this, if you take off the dust cover and open it up, there is this brilliant, it turns into this brilliant poster, doesn't it?
Yeah, the dust jacket for the book unfolds into a big poster featuring, I think, 32 stories that Dave Eggers wrote, and that jacket, or a version of that jacket, was originally published as the cover of our 23rd issue of our quarterly, and on the reverse of it, it's a reversible poster, is a poster of portraits drawn by Charles Burns, who is the great graphic novelist who does the cover portraits for all of the Believer magazine issues.
And in fact, inside the Art of McSweeney's, you can see a step-by-step process he did for one of the music issues of the Believer, and you see how he goes from sketch to final product.
Yeah, that's a fantastic little piece. You get to see not only how an artist works, but also how, you know, the cover of this magazine is kind of conceived and then executed.
It seems that at the heart of all of this is respect for the reader, that you're not taking the reader for granted.
Yeah, I mean, I think that this book is great for anybody who cares about the printed word and cares about books and art and things like that. But, you know, it's also a little bit about us trying to give back to this readership that we have that's been incredibly loyal to us and is always incredibly supportive in times when we've been in need and things. And so this is definitely for our readers to get a glimpse into what we do to try and provide them with the quarterly and the magazines and the novels on a somewhat timely basis.
If you're a small staff and you try to be somewhat timely, as you say, what is it like as you approach a deadline there at McSweeney's?
You know, it can vary, and we've been trying to be a little bit better about our deadlines, but generally, as a deadline approaches, you know, tempers flare, and, you know, hair grows greasier, and it becomes just sort of a little bit of a mess, but, you know, it's always a relief when we send something to press.
Chris Ying is co-publisher of the new book, The Art of McSweeney's. This is a book fair edition of Ozarks at Large. Local support for Ozarks at Large comes from Rolando's Restaurant, serving Nuevo Latino cuisine in downtown Rogers, downtown Fort Smith, and Central Avenue in Hot Springs. Open for lunch and dinner Monday through Saturday. Next on KUAF, NPR is hosting the National Day of Listening with Neil Conan and StoryCorps founder Dave Isay. In a time when it's common to find differences with our family, friends, neighbors, and politicians, this year's National Day of Listening, which takes place tomorrow, promotes civil conversation and understanding. The third annual National Day of Listening asks all Americans to take an hour to record a conversation with a loved one during this busy holiday season. And NPR begins the conversation a day early next on the National Day of Listening. That's beginning next on KUAF, 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Fort Smith, Rogers, Siloam Springs. Your NPR affiliate for the past 25 years and your source for community events. Remember, you can enter your own community event information at our website, KUAF.com. And it is time for the KUAF and Friends Holiday Giveaway. Thanks to our KUAF underwriters, it's our chance to give back to you. You could win a gift from Belen Manor Bed and Breakfast, David Adams Fine Jewelers, Greenhouse Grill, or Ortega's Espresso Cafe, and more. Details and registration are available on the web at our site, KUAF.com. The drawing will be held Thursday, December 16th, during Classical Music with P.J. Hrabowski. Please, just one entry per person. Thanks and good luck. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF 91.3 FM. I'm Kyle Kelms. Thanks so much for listening. Tomorrow, the day after Thanksgiving, another book fair edition of Ozarks at Large. And our all-new regular editions of Ozarks at Large will return Monday at noon. Remember, you can hear Ozarks at Large every day at noon on KUAF 91.3 FM, every Monday through Friday, that is. And then you can hear weekend edition Ozarks at Large Sunday mornings at 9. For more information about the program or to listen again to one of the interviews you've heard today, you can go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com.